I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Welcome to Radio Times. Back in 1997, Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro introduced the Fairness Paycheck Act to ensure that men and women in the same job got the same pay. It did not become law. She reintroduced her bill this session, as she has done in previous years, and it passed the House last week, 242 to 187, with seven Republicans joining all the Democrats. It prevents employers from asking job candidates about their previous salaries and requires employers to give their salary data to the Equal Opportunity Employment Commission to determine if there is discrimination. It also allows workers to discuss their salaries with their colleagues. While the pay gap has slowly narrowed, the average woman working full-time earns about 82 cents for every dollar an equivalent man earns. For women of color, the gap is even wider, closer to 60 cents. There are complicated reasons for this difference that has profound societal implications. Well, today is Equal Pay Day. Why does this disparity persist, and what would get us closer to parity? Joining us is Jocelyn Fry. She's senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. She served for 4 years as deputy assistant to President Obama and director of policy and special projects for First Lady Michelle Obama. Jocelyn Fry, nice to have you with us from Radio Times.
Well, thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
Nice to have you with us. And also with us is Hannah Riley Bowles. She's the Roy E. Larson Senior Lecturer in Public Policy and Management at the Harvard Kennedy School. She chairs the school's Management, Leadership, and Decision Sciences area and co-directs the Women in Public Policy program. Hannah Riley Bowles, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you. Delighted to be joining the conversation.
And such an important one to have. Let me just give out the phone number to our listeners and ways that they can join our conversation. It's 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. It seems there are many ways we can slice and dice this conversation, whether we're talking about average or typical or median. And let me start with you, Jocelyn Fry. When we're talking about disparity, Are we talking about men and women in the same job with essentially the same work history getting paid something different? Or are we talking about jobs that are largely filled by female workers versus male workers, and that's where we're seeing the disparity? Or is it the both of them?
Well, the answer is both of them, actually. And you're right, you can slice and dice the data in a lot of different ways. When people talk about the gender wage gap generally, typically they're talking about big picture, all of the occupations combined together, and you get the, depending on the data source, either 80 cents or 82 cents as the gender wage gap. And as you point out, if you look at women of color, it's even lower, 61 cents for black women, 53 cents for Latinas, and even lower for other female workers. So there's the big general number. But even if you look within occupation, by and large, across all of the occupations, there is a gender wage gap. It varies for each occupation. We just looked at, if you look at the Bureau of Labor Statistics data for 125 occupations, almost all of those occupations, men earn higher. The gender wage gap can go as far as, 69 cents in some of those occupations, and sometimes it may be 90 cents. But whether you look at the occupations or just generally, you generally find a wage gap.
Let me turn to you, Hannah Riley Bowles. Big question here, and I will probably spend the rest of the hour discussing it. But what do you think has made this disparity so enduring? And it has shrunk in the last generation or two, but nonetheless, it's still here.
Well, I mean, probably the one thing that's made it so enduring is the gender division of household labor. So the latest studies, for instance, by Claudia Golden, Harvard economist, on the gender wage gap show that, where the most extreme gaps emerge once you control for factors such as, education, years in the workforce, occupation, is in those jobs where there are, extreme hours and required of, extreme hours, devotion to the workplace, lots of travel and stuff like that. I mean, those types of, we call them kind of extreme work. Those types of jobs are where you tend to see the biggest pay gaps between men and women, or those occupations that reward that type of extreme work, because men are just more likely to be able to devote themselves to that type of extreme work because of the gender division of household labor. Women are more likely to be in caregiving roles with children or family members, and as a result, pursue more flexible work arrangements that that aren't as highly remunerated. If I can give you an example from Claudia's work, she compares, for instance, pharmacists to lawyers. And what she finds is a very small gender wage gap, if any, among pharmacists. And she argues that among pharmacists, your 20-hour-a-week pharmacist is making about half what your 40-hour-a-week pharmacist is making. But then she says, go look over at lawyers. Well, your 40 or 50-hour-a-week lawyer is typically making a lot less than half than your 80 or 100-hour-a-week lawyer. And so what you'll find is that men will be more likely to be in those more highly remunerated, better paid, more extreme work situations, such as those, the corporate lawyer, and women will be more likely to have chosen a job within the legal profession that gives them a little bit more flexibility. I'm not arguing that this is all about women's choice, mm-hmm. But I think what's really important to recognize is that this is really the penalties for a need for work flexibility, and the traditional gender division of household labor are probably the biggest obstacles we've yet to overcome.
And that's really focusing on these more, as you say, extreme work or more sort of high-end so-called professional jobs. Jocelyn Frey, let me go back to you, but also talk about the fact that when you look at more low-paid work or even shift work, are you more likely to see women doing those kinds of jobs?
Well, for a couple of reasons, and Hannah is absolutely right in terms of pointing to Professor Golden's work and looking at just how women work generally. Across the board, women tend to have more caregiving responsibilities. And as a result, what you find even in low-wage occupations is that women are more likely to be in those jobs, primarily because they're often cobbling together different types of work opportunities in order to both do some work, but also make sure that they're available to pick up the kids or take a child to the doctor or a parent to the doctor or so forth. So, when you look at the wage gap generally, there are multiple factors that are driving that wage gap, some of which is discrimination, mm-hmm. some of which is where women are working, occupational segregation, more specifically, some of it is the gap in work hours, that women are working less because they have more responsibilities at home, they do more unpaid work, and take on more hours at home. So all of those together are driving that gap, whether you're talking about high wage workers or low wage workers.
Jocelyn Frey, I heard that described as the mommy penalty. Is that how we should think about it?
It's certainly a piece of the puzzle, to be sure. I mean, it's not only moms who have caregiving responsibilities, but you definitely see a motherhood gap. And it is in part because of this enormous responsibility that they are taking on at home. There's research that we put out a couple of years ago that looked at unpaid work, and women across the board are doing more at home, whether it's just, working with the kids, doing homework, preparing meals, taking people to appointments, like all of those, when you combine it, women have more hours. So I think all of that is driving the gap, and moms are among the workers who pay the sharpest price for that gap.
What I found so interesting in doing some homework for the show, Hannah Riley Bowles, is that while we're obviously focusing on the United States, it's also true in other countries that have more family-friendly policies. We're still seeing a gender wage gap. Is that significant? Does that tell us something about what the solutions might be?
Well, I think that's right. Well, one, the solution isn't just, family leave policy. I think that's very important part of this. But definitely when you look internationally, there are a lot of things that matter. One thing is the social cultural expectations with regard to women's work, and also with regard to men's role in the household. So if you compare places like Japan and Korea, for instance, to the Nordic countries in terms of the expectations of men's participation in caregiving activities, they're really different culturally, right? So even if you're in a culture in which it is just simply not expected or even looked down upon that the man would engage in caregiving labor, then even if you offer family leave to men, they don't take it. Whereas in cultures that have really emphasized that, men's engagement in fatherhood, in family life is important for the culture nationally, for the health of the country, for the health of the next generation, then you see more men engaging in that. But even in the Nordic countries, I mean, it's very interesting. This was something that these are attitudes and practices that developed over time. For instance, there's an interesting study showing in one of the Nordic countries showing that men, when they initially were provided paternity leave opportunities, were significantly more likely to take them if a supervisor in their organization had taken them, right? So you still need that kind of social permission that you're not violating the expectations of what the ideal worker, the high-achieving worker looks like. And men do have, it's not an illegitimate desire to be, an important breadwinner. It's a question of whether the society is just expecting men in those roles. I'll give you another example. In the Arab Gulf, you actually have more women graduating from university and a lot of women graduating with technical degrees. But because the male breadwinner model is so strong, only a minority, a small minority of those women coming out of university will be working for pay, within a few years of graduation because of these cultural norms.
Well, as I said, this is a complicated issue. It is Equal Pay Day, although we should say that for African Americans, Equal Pay Day doesn't come until later this summer. And for Latinas, it happens in the fall. But nonetheless, it is Equal Pay Day. And we're talking about the disparity, the enduring disparity between how men and women are paid. Talking with Hannah Riley Bowles, the voice you just heard, and she chairs Harvard Kennedy School's Management Leadership and Decision Sciences area. She also co-directs the Women and Public Policy Program. Jocelyn Fry is with us as well from the Center for American Progress, where she is a senior fellow. And again, she served for 4 years as Deputy Assistant to President Obama, Director of Policy and Special Projects for First Lady Michelle Obama. We want to hear from you. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Much more to talk about after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, and we're talking about the fact that it's Equal Pay Day, spending the hour looking at the gender pay gap. And again, studies show that women working full-time make about 82 cents for every dollar that their male colleagues make. And for women of color, that disparity is even larger, closer to 60 cents for every dollar. And again, talking with Jocelyn Fry and with Hannah Riley Bowles. Jocelyn Fry, let me go back to you and actually talk a bit about this this bill that was passed last week having to do with the Fairness Paycheck Act. And it allows workers to discuss their salaries with their colleagues. And I will express my ignorance. I didn't know people were not allowed to talk about their salaries at work. How significant is that?
Well, it's important. I would say a couple of things. As a general matter, there are lots of employers where it is permissible to speak about your salaries. But there is a strong work culture that really discourages people from talking about pay. And this is always been true. And there are employers who have rules and say that you're not supposed to talk about your pay. Sometimes they have them in place, even if those rules are not technically permissible. There are some legal protections that say that you're not supposed to prevent people from talking about their pay, but sometimes people don't know that.
Right.
So as a result, there are many situations in the workplace where people just feel discouraged or think they're not supposed to talk about their pay. They have no idea what other folks make. And, you know, this is one of the notorious problems with pay discrimination, is that people simply don't know if they're being underpaid. And if you look at, like, the case that people talk a lot about, which is Lilly Ledbetter's case.
I just scribbled her name down on my
exactly.
piece of paper. Yes.
Exactly. And, you know, she will tell you herself that she had no idea until somebody slipped a note in her locker. And that's the way that pay discrimination works. So being able to discuss it openly, ask people questions, is really a critical piece of the puzzle to tackling pay discrimination.
Hannah Riley Bowles, let me go to you. And let's talk about how women negotiate and whether that is a problem, whether either women feel like they shouldn't negotiate their salary, they don't know how to negotiate their salary, or when they do, they're seen as being pushy or overly aggressive. How important is that?
Well, I think your last point is extremely important, and building on Jocelyn's comments, I mean, one of there is this evidence that women are less likely to negotiate for higher pay than men are, and we see that across numerous studies. But our best explanation for why women are more reluctant to negotiate for higher pay than men is because they are more likely to face social backlash or uh-huh. negative social consequences for doing so. So it is actually really important. This new bill has got a component promoting negotiation training for women, which I'm a little ambivalent about, and I'll express why. But I think what's really critical is if they're going to promote negotiation, more negotiation by women as part of the solution, it's really critical that they have put in these provisions to protect workers from discrimination because they asked about pay. Ah. I think that's those two things. It's really important to couple those two things. On the salary negotiation part, I mean, I think I've sat in on some of our salary negotiation training programs here in Boston, and they're wonderful events. I mean, just for the experience of these women coming together and cheering each other on and sharing experiences and, you know, setting goals and talking about their aspirations. They're really, from what I've seen, extremely positive events. But I worry a little bit about our becoming overly focused on pay, and in particular people saying, well, look, women make 82 cents in the dollar. They need to negotiate better because, you know, going back to Jocelyn's opening comments, the gender wage gap, most of the gender wage gap is really about different career paths that men and women end up taking. And they take those different career paths in part because of the family issues that we've discussed, in part because there are gendered expectations with regard to the roles that men and women will play in society. What I would argue really importantly is that it's very important that women not just negotiate their pay, but that they make sure that they're negotiating themselves into situations where they are on an upwardly mobile career trajectory, or at a minimum, sustainably meaningfully employed. So the 82 cents on the dollar just compares full-time employed men and women. But for a lot of women, they will make a decision that they can't reconcile their work demands with their caregiving demands, and they end up departing the workforce or reducing their hours substantially. And that has very meaningful wealth implications, yeah.
Absolutely. Well, Jocelyn Fry, let me go back to you and talk about the fact that largely in this country, there are many jobs where you don't get sick days, for instance. Child care is expensive if mm-hmm. you can find the kind of good quality child care that would, you know, make a mom or a dad or a family feel secure about their child. How much would addressing these kind of benefits that we think of, making them more common for everybody?
Well, it would have an enormous impact. I mean, I agree absolutely with Hannah. I mean, I think when you think about the gender wage gap, what you have to think about is that there are different pieces of the puzzle, right? Like the Paycheck Fairness Act deals with one piece. It deals mostly with discrimination. But then there are other things like paid family leave, paid sick days, which really deal with the other part of the problem, which is, as Hannah pointed out, you know, the difference in work hours and the difference in expectations in terms of women caring for their families. If you had things like paid sick days, paid family leave, women would be able to better sort of manage those responsibilities and be away from work, but then go back to work. And if you had those policies in place, also men would feel more empowered to do that as well, because we know when you have gender-neutral policies like they have in California with their paid family leave program, men's participation in family care actually goes up a little bit. So gender neutrality is important. The other piece of the puzzle, though, and you're quite right to point out low-wage workers versus high-wage workers, is we also know that low-wage workers tend to have less access to those sorts of policies. So there's the added stress of not only having to manage family, but often having to do so without access to paid sick days or paid family leave. And so then they do have to leave work or lose a job in order to make sure that there's the proper pickup or that, you know, the parent has the proper care at a certain time. So these pieces all fit together, and having national policy that deals with these issues helps to level the playing field for everybody, including low-wage and high-wage workers.
We just did a show recently about shift workers, and I don't want to spend the full hour on it, but it's just something I think, Jocelyn Fry, we should just remember that for many of these more low-wage jobs, many of these workers don't have much control over their work hours, and that can just add to the sort of chaos of trying to manage everything.
Well, that's absolutely right, and there's legislation that's been pending on the Hill that deals with fair scheduling, because many shift workers don't have control of their schedules, or they set a time and say that they're going to be on shift, and then they get a last minute change, and that throws their child care into awry. So I think you're right that we also need to be thinking about fair scheduling practices and thinking about workers who are independent contractors, gig workers, who don't even have any of these protections at all, right? Like it's a big puzzle, and you have to think about all the different components to making sure that people are getting fair pay and actually have a level of economic security.
Let me read a couple of comments here. One from Rick said, I spent 26 years in the Army, and in my experience, pay was always equal among genders in the military. Also a comment from Art. He says, a major, often conveniently overlooked reason for the pay gap is the reality that women tend to avoid dangerous, hazardous jobs that involve much higher risk of physical injury and death. And I wonder, Hannah Riley Bowles, if you could respond to his comment there.
Well, I think that's right, that, that type of work, high hazard work, and particularly masculine, stereotyped, that type of work has traditionally been very highly paid. There are, and it should be. I mean, I wouldn't contest that. And I think you do see fewer women than men going into those things. I think there are a lot of other places where workers kind of question some of those divisions. So, for instance, there was an action taken, I think, here at Harvard, I believe, where the cafeteria workers challenged whether they should be paid less than the janitors. And they argued that actually if you broke down the work that they did, that it was very similar, but there had just been a tradition of paying custodial staff higher than the cafeteria workers. The cafeteria workers are overwhelmingly female. The custodial staff were overwhelmingly male. I think if you look at occupations like nursing, which has been traditionally associated with women, we tend to associate it, therefore, with kind of caregiving and nurturing roles. But now that we're trying to get more men into nursing because there's such demand, we're emphasizing how much of it is about emergency response, how much of it is about actually carrying heavy things, equipment and people. There's a lot of real physical elements to that work that we haven't emphasized as much in the past because we associated it with women. So I think that's a good point. I think you're also finding, as these gender stereotypes loosen and we look more critically at these things, that there are increasing numbers of women going into the military, even combat roles, into firefighting. And they've also done that in spite of it being, you know, not always a very welcoming environment. I mean, they really have had to kind of earn their stripes. That's going to vary across situations. But they've, you see a lot of women bravely entering those spaces. Could I go back, though, to this really important point about socioeconomic status or education level that Jocelyn was raising? And I really think that the strategies that we need to implement are really different for more privileged and less privileged workers. So, for instance, just take negotiation example. Negotiation is really, to negotiate your pay and your career path is really a privilege of the higher educated and typically the professional class. For less educated workers, they are more interchangeable. If you're lower skilled, you're more easily replaced, and it's very hard in those types of positions to be negotiating your way to higher pay. What the research on, for instance, organized labor suggests is that one reason that unions help reduce the wage gap is because they are just simply increasing the wages of the lowest paid workers. And so for less privileged women in those less skilled occupations, it may be that we have to focus more on changing the circumstances for the lowest paid. Again, also on the family leave issue, it's so interesting. It's really this extreme work problem is, again, a problem of the professional class. You know, it's not, you know, those super high payoffs of extreme work are really going to those people like, you know, doctors and lawyers and corporate executives. It's not for the extreme worker who is low paid. Sure. And cobbling together a whole bunch of different shifts. And so where progress is going to be made around, you know, at that professional class is where we show evidence, like with the reason why there's less of a gap between the male and the female pharmacist, or the hourly wages of the part-time versus the full-time pharmacist, is because it has made the pharmacist more interchangeable because they're working in these large companies. When they come in, they're doing the same role as the person in the shift before them. They log into the computer, all the information is there.
Sort of like the military in a way.
Yeah, well, in some respects, right. Yes, exactly. And so you get a payoff for being a more kind of distinctive commodity among the privileged workers. I'll just throw one more thing.
Well, you know what? Let me just jump in here, only because I'm looking at the clock, and I do want to get Jocelyn Fry back in on the conversation. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Hannah, hold on to that thought. And Jocelyn, I want to shift gears here, but I'm looking at something you wrote for Center for American Progress. And you wrote, for years, Black women have had the highest labor force participation rate among women. And you go on to describe that it's closer to 60% versus more like 55% and around in the lower 50s for other women in this country. And yet when we look at overall speaking, looking at the pay, there's that 60 cent to a dollar disparity. What is holding Black women back?
Well, I think there are a couple of things, and thank you for raising it. I think, first of all, what we know is that in addition to a gender gap, there's also a race gap. And this is true for Black workers across the board, and it's true for Latino workers as well. And so, you know, it reinforces the underlying point that there are many different factors that are driving the wage gap. The other thing we know is where African-American women work, there is a high level of occupational segregation, and they tend to be in traditionally female jobs and that are less lower paid. They're more likely to be minimum wage workers, which, you know, by definition are lower paid jobs. But, you know, there's also a piece of this that is unexplained. I mean, going back to where we started with work that's been done by Francine Blau and Larry Katz, where they've really broken down the wage gap, one of the things you find is there's this unexplained portion that people often attribute to discrimination. And I think we have to acknowledge that there are a whole set of cultural attitudes that people bring to the workplace and whose work is more valued, who we think are the best workers. And all of that feeds into how Black women are paid, white women are paid, Latinas, and every other worker. So we, if we're talking about fixing the problem, we have to be comprehensive about fixing the problem.
Are you talking about implicit bias or maybe explicit bias? But I think implicit bias is the bias that we don't recognize. It's not the sort of obvious bias, but it's there.
You know, that's absolutely right. And I think, you know, you can't put it all on that, but certainly that's a piece of the puzzle. And whether it's just, you know, expectations about who is a good worker or whose attitude you like and whose you don't, you know, going back to Hannah's point about negotiations, you know, if you come across as aggressive, you know, is there perception of the angry Black woman stereotype? Like, all of those things matter in terms of how people are perceived and how people are paid. And if we want to grapple with the problem, then we have to acknowledge that all of those factors contribute. And I do want to make a point. Your caller who wrote in, and I think he made an excellent point about the Army and the military. And the reality is, in the public sector, sometimes you see less pay disparities because their salaries are public.
Right.
And so people
know.
Yes,
they are. I know that very well.
And
yes.
People know what they're paid, you know, and so and they know the different grades, and it's very clear. And it's one of the reasons that in the Paycheck Fairness Act that they have data collection, that people want greater pay transparency around pay because it matters.
Well, let's pick up on that. I'm sure, Hannah, you've got some things to add to that as well. And again, we are talking about the fact that it is Equal Pay Day and looking at the gender pay gap, the disparity between what men and women are paid and, frankly, what to do about it. That's Jocelyn Fry. Hannah Riley Bowles is with us as well. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Stay with us. Much more after the break. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. It is Equal Pay Day, and on this hour of Radio Times, we're talking about why men continue to be paid more than women in the workplace, generally speaking, what role career choices and things like sex discrimination play in the disparity, what can be done to shrink the gap. Also talking about this in light of the fact that last week the Paycheck Fairness Act was passed by the House of Representatives addressing discrimination when it comes to pay. And our guests are Jocelyn Fry. She's senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. She served for 4 years as deputy assistant to President Obama and director of policy and special projects for First Lady Michelle Obama. And Hannah Riley Bowles is with us as well. She's the Roy E. Larson Senior Lecturer in Public Policy and Management at the Harvard Kennedy School. She chairs the school's Management, Leadership, and Decision Sciences area and also co-directs the Women and Public Policy Program. And again, you can join our conversation with questions or comments 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Hannah, let me read a Facebook comment from Marcy and give you a chance to respond. She says, don't ever put your current salary on your application for a new job. My dad, who's a lawyer, had to tell me to stop doing that because it allows pay discrimination to follow you. Do you agree with that? And I believe this Paycheck Fairness Act addresses some of that.
Yes, yes. There's a lot of discussion about that. We've got it. I read that also, and we've just recently passed similar legislation here in Massachusetts. I mean, it is important that there are now, in a variety of places, people are trying to restrict employers from requiring job candidates to reveal previous pay because it could, you know, anchor you at a lower salary if in the past you were paid less well than other people in your position or if you were in a lower paid occupation. So I think there's some I think the data are still out on how effective that will be, but I think the spirit of the comment is right. I think you want to make sure what you most want to do when you're in a negotiation, I think you want to get the best information you can to start off with an expectation that's as high as realistically possible. And then what you want to make sure is that you don't walk away from the negotiation without understanding, without comparing what's on the table to what you would get if you walked away, right? So you can, if you know how much you would make in another position, you can say, well, I've been offered this at another place, or I know that people with my skills can be paid at XYZ. That your kind of walk away should be the bottom end of the negotiation, not what you were paid in the past.
Fair enough. Let me go back to you, Jocelyn Fry, and this is the day we sort of mark when it comes to pay disparity. But it is interesting when you look at Asian American women that the pay gap is probably the narrowest among women, and I'm curious what that tells us.
It's a great point. The data suggests that the pay gap for them is around 85 cents.
Yeah.
And I think there are a couple of different things going on. One is that the population as a general matter includes a number of subpopulations. If you actually look at the smaller groups, you know, people from Vietnam versus folks who are from who are Laotian versus Chinese women versus Japanese, you actually see that pay gap spread out enormously. The National Women's Law Center has a great fact sheet that sort of teases it out and shows that, you know, folks in some subpopulations are actually earning 58 cents. And then there's some who are earning a lot more. So I think it has to do both with the fact that that Asian population, Asian American Pacific Islander population, is very diverse, and that you're really talking about a lot of smaller groups of folks all together in that one number. I think there's also a difference in terms of when people came to this country. In some instances, there are folks who had higher incomes who were able to come to for certain types of work versus other folks who Cambodian, who in Vietnamese, Hmong communities who tend to be in lower wage jobs. Mm-hmm. So I think there are lots of different things feeding that number. And, you know, even as you point out, the multiple equal pay days, last year they recognized.
Right, exactly.
Right, Southeast Asian Equal Pay Day that actually occurs in the fall because many of the folks who are from Southeast Asian countries actually are amongst the lowest wage workers. So I think there's a lot of analysis you have to do when you look at that population because it is so diverse.
Sure. Let me get to, it looks like Noreen from Pottstown to join our conversation. And Noreen, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, hi.
Hi there.
I just wanted to make a comment that I think we do need state and federal laws to give the security to the workers for paid sick days and paid family leave, because the reality is everyone seems to have one very young person or very old person that they're responsible for, and the stress when these unplanned for doctor visits come up, people are really or constant insecurity of losing a job over the fact that we need to care for family. I just think as a society we need to really understand and respect the fact that we as human beings need to care for one another. And I think that people say, well, where does that money come from? And I just think that between simple things like a small Wall Street tax on trading or having the multi-billion dollar corporations like Amazon pay their fair share of taxes or reducing our bloated military budget to take some of this money that really is out there that we can take toward things that are important, it's bipartisan, things that so insecure with their positions because you simply have to care for someone in your family that may be very old or very young. It just seems to kind of be a sad spotlight on what's going on here in America. And thank you for letting me make that comment.
Absolutely, Noreen. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. You said a bunch of really important things. Hannah, you want to respond to Noreen's comment?
Yeah, no, I think it's an extremely important comment. I think it's important to recognize that paid family leave is not just a women's issue. It's really an inequality issue. And it's also about families, not just women. But what the data suggests is that, you know, the the least privileged workers are the ones that are going to benefit most from paid family leave policies. A lot of privileged workers get access to these types of policies through their organizations already. So the benefits, the largest benefits, tend to accrue to those most vulnerable workers. And as Jocelyn was describing earlier, you know, paid sick days and paid family leave are just extremely important for workers who, have income fragility. You know,
sure.
They could lose their job if they don't show up, right? Or if they're trying to cobble together a whole variety of shifts. And it's very important for the children and the next generation of families that what we're providing for. So I think it's a very important policy that we should advocate for reducing inequality in our country more broadly, and not only for reducing the gender wage gap.
Jocelyn Fry, I'm just picking up on what Hannah Riley Bowles just said there, because you think if a woman is making less over a period of her lifetime, by the time she reaches retirement age, her little Social Security pot is going to be smaller, which means that in older age or even old age, she's going to have less to live on and she's going to need help.
Well, I mean, you summed it up in a nutshell. I mean, that is part of the problem here. When you look at women's lifetime earnings over, let's say, a 40-year career, you can see losses as much as $400,000, $500,000. It's even higher for Black women, closer to $1 million.
Wow.
And over $1 million for Latinas. And those dollars add up. Nobody can afford just to leave money on the table, as they say. And, you know, statistically, women live longer, and lower wages means lower retirement. And that's not only a strain on them, but it potentially is a strain on the country more broadly in terms of people needing access to services and supports. And so I think for all of those reasons, you want people paid fairly, but you also just want people paid fairly because we think that fairness makes sense, right? Like, you know, equal pay is not controversial to most people, you know, men and women across races. People agree people ought to be paid fairly for their work. So this ought not to be a controversial issue, even though it gets caught up in the partisan context of Washington. These issues ought to be pretty straightforward for most people.
Hannah, let me go back to you. And more women go to law school and medical school than men. I think for single women, the disparity is probably not as great as it is for women with children. It seems that also younger women, at least broadly speaking, there's more parity between what they get paid and what a man gets paid. Is this about education? Is this about sort of cultural differences? Is it the kind of choices that women make or the choices that they are sort of forced to make?
I mean, those are great questions. So, I mean, if you look at, lawyers and doctors as an example, yes, I mean, you're going to find less gender disparity in what they're paid starting out, in part because of that, you know, interchangeable worker issue, right? So the recent graduates all look pretty similar, and there's typically not a lot of bargaining room in those early entry points of one's career. Where you start seeing the income gaps emerge is, again, around childbearing years. You know, it's into your later 20s and 30s and onward, you see the gap spread substantially. And again, it does go to how different types of work is remunerated. So among, among doctors, you see a lot of women in, general practice or pediatric practices or OBGYN. And again, that's because they can share the work and trade off where you see, higher rewards. Even anesthesiologists, interesting, Claudia Golden was using the example, is that you typically buy into an anesthesiology team, and then there will be a member of that team will show up for a particular surgery. But when you get to surgeons, there is more of this, you know, distinctive characteristics of the individual for, you know, for which people pay. And there's also just grueling expectations in terms of, you know, time availability and devotion to the profession. So you see the statistics on women in surgery really don't look nearly as healthy as some other areas pediatrics.
That's really interesting. And that's Hannah Riley Bowles joining us along with Jocelyn Fry. We are marking Equal Pay Day here on Radio Times. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Jocelyn Fry, let me go back to you. Are there reasons, though, and perhaps having to do with experience or education or training or so-called factors other than sex, that are not discriminatory, but just sort of acknowledge the fact that that men have a different job work trajectory compared to women?
Well, I think, you know, that's certainly a fair point, and I don't think anybody really disagrees with pay differences that are due to legitimate factors, you know, things like more education, more training, more experience. You know, I think those are certainly entirely appropriate factors to consider in setting a salary. I think, you know, the problem is simply that when you look at the data, what you find is even when you control for all those factors, there is still a disparity. And that's really what people are focused on is, you know, when you put aside all the explainable factors, you know, what else is going on? And to the extent that there's something unexplainable that looks like discrimination, we have an obligation to try to fix it and make it better. I think the other thing that is important around, you know, the term any factor other than sex, which is a defense that can be used in the context of the Equal Pay Act, is that because the courts have looked at that law fairly narrowly, there are sometimes things that, you know, may sound neutral, but in fact, they are just a way of covering up gender bias. The classic case is market forces. You know, I didn't really want to discriminate against the woman. It's just that the market calls for me to pay more to the man. You know, that's a convenient excuse, but you know, in 2019, you can't really just say the market made me do it, right? Like, you have to have a better excuse than that. So, the law has been slow to catch up. And part of the purpose of the Paycheck Fairness Act is to try to get us into 2019, really looking at people equally and fairly.
We're almost out of time here, Hannah, but do you think it got through the House and it did get 7 Republicans in support of it? Do you think it will make it through the Senate? And to our president's desk?
Yeah, I mean, I hope so. I don't know. I won't put any bets on it. I mean, I very much hope so. I'd love to close on this. I've really emphasized the career trajectory point and the household labor, but I think that Jocelyn makes a very good point about discrimination. And I want to go back to also her point about race and that, you know, there's growing evidence that not only women are resisted when they try to self-advocate for higher pay, but also Black Americans. And I think that one thing that's really important is around this negotiation stuff that we make sure that, you know, all workers have the same privileges to self-advocate, not only for their pay, but also for their career trajectories.
Well, we're going to leave it there on a positive note. Hannah Riley Bowles, thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
And she's the Roy E. Larson Senior Lecturer in Public Policy and Management at the Harvard Kennedy School, where she co-directs the Women in Public Policy program. Jocelyn Fry, thank you so much for joining us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And she's Senior Fellow at the Center for American Progress. Adam Staniszewski is our engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, and the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.